Hi, my name's Russell Norman, and this is a podcast called Read Lots, Write Lots, a podcast for those who love to write. As always, we have a great episode lined up. In our writing tips segment, Deidre will be talking about write small to write big. But firstly, we'll be talking to Cruche Hilton. Cruche Hilton writes under the pen name Shay West. She mostly writes in the contemporary and young adult genre. She has always wanted to be a writer and took the leap in the past 2 years by posting her stories online at Readzy Prompts. As part of her passion for writing, she tries to write something every day. A few of her stories can also be found on Beth Connor's podcast, Crossroads Cantina. When not writing, you can find her reading late into the night and watching way too many TikToks and hollering at her kids, "Get down from there," and "Hands are for high fives, not for hitting." Cruche owns Pacific Northwest Doulas, where she works as a birth and postpartum doula and child birth educator, supporting people through pregnancy, birth, and postpartum. She lives in Oregon with her lovely husband and 3 children and her dog, Freddie Mercury. Over to you, Deidre.
Thanks, Russell. Cruche Hilton, we are so happy to have you. And first of all, we need to thank somebody who's watching a 4-year-old, a 7-year-old, and an 11-year-old right now. Who's doing the honors tonight?
Yeah, that would be my lovely husband, as you so titled him. I don't know if I'd ever say he's lovely. He'd probably be like, "Can we document that?"
he's watching 3 kids for a couple hours. He's lovely.
Yeah,
and we have to address the elephant in the room, and that is our obsession with TikTok. Look, if China's artificial intelligence is right, I'm personally concerned about myself because the algorithm and what they feed me on my TikTok feed, that's truly terrifying. I stay awake far too long worrying about that. Actually, I probably stay awake far too long watching dad bods and beards like driving through the woods. Is that what you get, the same feed? Okay.
Oh my god.
Is it just me?
So I've been vetted to make all of the birth-oriented TikTok videos for our agency that I co-own. And let me tell you, like, if there's ever a moment to just kind of like let all inhibition go, it's like when you're 38 years old making a TikTok.
Right. And I'm sure the comment section is worthy of just skipping right over. I don't know if,
yeah.
I don't think there's been a comment ever written on the internet since its inception that has been useful. But yeah. You are useful. Go a little bit into being a doula.
Yeah, so I've been a doula for about 9 years now. It was not what I set out to do as my career. I was actually a career chef for a really long time. I did pastry work and wedding cakes and things like that and worked in Las Vegas and fine dining. And it wasn't until I had my first child and had the experience that I had, which was rather traumatic, and then the postpartum experience as well, when my sister-in-law, who's a labor and delivery nurse, was like, "Have you ever heard of a doula?" And I was like, "No, what's that?" And she's like, "I think you'd be really good at it." And so the rest is kind of history. I kind of became what I needed at that time and have continued to do that for the past 9 years now, supporting people in birth and pregnancy and postpartum and all of the above.
That's wonderful. And having had 3 children myself there in various stages of delivery, God bless you people. Well, I notice on your bio on Readzy, you say you have just enough trauma to make you funny.
But yeah, just enough.
Yeah, just still like a functioning adult. And I certainly appreciate that. So with this writing journey that you've taken on about a year ago, or has it been longer? Or
it really kind of started when like the world kind of went upside down on us. And I was at home with 3 kids and then trying to manage all of these things. And I was like, I got to do something for myself. And it just kind of came to be as things do.
So like a time for self-reflection and you mentioned self-care.
Yeah.
So how have you grown as a person kind of writing these amazing stories? Because you have, you handle life and death in your hands. I mean, you've seen some amazing things. And so I would imagine, a lot of your stories have kind of treads on those themes.
I would say that it's just been a lot of reflection of like, I get to work with all kinds of people. And even though like pregnancy is pregnancy is pregnancy, each person who carries a baby is different. Each baby that they carry is different. Each partner or non-existent partner that shows up to this family dynamic is different. And so for me, it's kind of like this constant changing of like, what kind of individuals do I get to support today? What will this look like as we navigate all the nuances of, you know, pregnancy and personality and like what they come to me with, you know, with their life history and things like that. So it's like this revolving door of supporting people exactly where they're at and attuning a lot, which I really like to do. I never get bored doing that.
Right. And so, and looking at some of your stories, Strong Exhale, really, I know it was your big winner there. But it really hit home with Hugo and Rayon, this really cute couple, and the idea of genetic traits kind of be passed down from, you know, from mother to daughter, and these dimples. And I'm noticing that you have dimples.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking that was a little autobiographical.
Probably.
Right. Yeah. I want to ask you about that story, but the idea that you talk about how babies are kind of born and they tell us, I'm sure you coach and educate people differently. I don't think I ever bought the tabula rasa, you know, that they're these blank slates just kind of come out and there they are. My mother came to each of my three deliveries and she called out their personalities within like an hour. My first child, this is 23 years ago. She held this grandchild and she had a bunch of grandchildren. So I think at that point you can kind of pick and choose who you like, but she held my son and said, "This one's sneaky." And I'm like, This baby is like still steamy. How are you calling this baby sneaky? And gosh darn it, 23 years later, I can tell you she was right. So she pretty much called it. And so when you see these like little creatures blink their eyes open, you know, what do you kind of, you know, and the story and the little girl, you know, how did this story come about? It's so rich and deep.
Well, that story came about because I'm sure like most people do, we tell ourselves that we're not good at certain things. And so then we believe that narrative. And I was reading all these stories where people are like, "Oh yeah, second person is very difficult to write in." And I was like, "Yeah, how do folks do that? I don't even know. I could never write it in that way." And I was like, whatever, I'll give it a try. And so I was literally sitting at my son's baseball practice. It was 100 degrees outside in the car, watching all of these kids play. And it was just this moment of like, yeah, these kids show up exactly who they are. And there are these moments in life where they like get shaped and, you know, turned into certain things, but like they show up a certain way. And so that's where that came from. Just like little, you know, tidbits from my life and, you know, stuff like that. But I really have a strong affection for that movie where, you know, John Cusack is holding the boombox above his head and mixtapes being like a thing and like how we don't really do mixtapes anymore. It's always like Spotify lists and podcasts and things like that. And I just thought there was something really cool, like having this tangible thing that this parent could leave her child and what's left behind when parents aren't here anymore.
And that's beautiful. The idea of something you can hang on to as opposed to something that exists in ones and zeros.
Yeah.
The notes we would pass in high school versus, you know, the text messages. Exactly. What is real. So, yeah. And certainly the love of this father for his daughter and that lovely marriage and the fact that, you know, you pointed out that Hugo's first three letters meant hug. I mean, that just kind of kind of got me. It's very sweet. And you do that. You throw in Just a little phrase or a detail that just completely warms up the entire story. It's fantastic. For me personally too, I read Wet Sheets, and I think this more than anything. I wish I'd read this 20 years ago when I was had all my pack of kids, three kids in 4 years, right? And how it's okay to say that raising children is rough. And it's kind of not fun to be the mom periodically. There's a writer back in the 14th century, a woman named Marjorie Kemp, and she was the first woman to write an autobiography. And she had quite a life. But I hand a copy of her autobiography to my students, and I give them a mental health intake form. And I'm like, read some of these passages, and then you try diagnose this poor woman because she's hallucinating and has mood swings and is violent and has all these kind of symptoms. And they come up with all kinds of things. And so then we talk about postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis. And they are always baffled because they're like, well, it's a baby. Yeah. It's the happiest day of your life, right? And I think your story, Wet Sheets, brings up some great, great details. You want to speak on that for a bit?
Yeah. So I actually wrote that story because you're right, Deidre. Here's the thing. Like, we can be incredibly like thrilled and excited and desperately want these this child and these children and these babies. And at the same time, be like, I'm living in the actual suck right now. Like, I hear it a lot and people are afraid to say it. It's like saying, if I say this thing, it means that this thing isn't true. And that's not the case. They can coexist. They're not mutually exclusive. Like, you can love your child and be also like, I can't wait till they're four because I don't want to do this part anymore. So working with families, that's a lot of the conversations we have of like giving people permission to say like, these feelings can coexist. Two things can be true at the same time. And so when I wrote Wet Sheets, I think the partner's voice sometimes goes very unaddressed and that like paternal postpartum depression is actually a thing. It's much, much smaller in comparison to maternal postpartum depression, but like men or people who identify as men get it too. Partners get it too. And so I really wanted to kind of address that, that there's something very biological about when men have babies or when their partners have babies, there's a shift for them, an identity shift more than anything.
Agreed. And also,
I'd also say too, there's something biological there.
Right. I think, some men I've talked to, very few that have been very honest and their first child was a daughter, that kind of threw them for a loop. They were like, they were really, you know, either hoping for a son or when they found out, you know, it was a daughter, they kind of had not every man, obviously, but there are disappointments and expectations people have. And, you know, when reality shows up, it's kind of challenging. And I think that's why, you know, writing and literature and reading short stories is important. One of the lines I loved in this short story of yours is, when was the last time I laughed? And that just really hit me hard because I remember being so exhausted and so tired and so concerned that these children are being, you know, fed and clothed and taken care of that I don't remember me at that time period.
Yeah, I think when you're like in that trench, I think I use that word a lot, the trench, like which trench of parenthood are you in? Like when you're in that trench, like, what are you feeling? Like, are you laughing? Are you able to enjoy your cup of coffee? Are you able to like get through your coffee without having to reheat it? Things like that. Like what can I even smile about? Sometimes it feels like that for people.
Right. And I'm sure part of your education is that this too shall pass, right? That's you'll eventually take a shower without, you know, in peace and quiet and before, you know, 3 p.m. So it's challenging, you know, bringing children into this world and taking good care of them. That is a lot of effort and time. And
it really is.
How lovely. It's the best thing in the world for sure. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned how like writing is your kind of your free therapy. And, you know, you capture these small moments that nobody talks about. And that makes them so relevant. And when people think, gosh, you know, is it just me? Am I the only one that feels this way? And so again, your short story Smile, again, brought me back to those awkward years, you know, 9, 10, 12, and really even the early 20s, when you're trying to figure out boys and boobs and bras and just, you know,
sure.
world and, you know, what society wants us to say. Either as people or as women, you know, like I'm fine. Oh, it's okay. It's all good. Right. We're fine. We're fine. So, talk to me about Smile. Cause I think you made a note that was your autobiography.
Yeah. That one is autobiography. Yeah, it is for sure. I jokingly say that I was raised with enough dysfunction and trauma to like still be like somewhat of a functioning adult. And now, but the reality is like, I had a really rough childhood. Like I lived on a Greyhound bus the first year of my life. And that was our house and lived through poverty and lived in bad neighborhoods and lived around people that just weren't great. You know, a lot of drug addicts and things like that. And so this was the narrative that I heard a lot, like just smile and get over yourself. It'll be fine. I mean, it's something that women are told a lot. Like we should just smile, sweetheart. But as a kid, like I heard it from really, really young. Like, why can't you just happy yourself into being, you know, feeling much better? And like when you come with that kind of trauma, that's not how that works. You don't just manifest things when you're 5 and 6 and 7 and 12 years old. Like there was no voice for me, so I just didn't use mine.
So had you always done self-expression as a child? Like, did you find the art and the arts, or how did you kind of, you know, I mean, writing is brand new. Cause I mean, you're whoever taught you grammar and syntax and diction, you're spot on. You had some pretty good teachers.
Yeah. So my grandma, my maternal grandmother, she was an English teacher, and funny thing about her, she never wanted to go to college or be a teacher, but her father, who was a very well-to-do man, said, "You'll go to college simply to be something more than just a housewife. Like, right. Like my daughters will be educated." Like that was his like mantra. And so she's like, "Fine, I guess I'll get an English degree." And, she taught school for a really long time, and she was an English teacher. And so the love of reading was always very much like put upon us in that way. Like we were always given books by them, and it was something I probably did to get like attention from adults. Like, look at all these books I'm reading. But, you know, eventually turned into a habit, so to speak, the lots of reading that I do.
Well, it's probably, probably from her too. I think, you know, as a child, I mean, I had three brothers who were mean. So just sort of run and hide in the library and find some books to escape was fantastic. Do you remember what books you read kind of helped shape you as a child? Or
yeah. So a lot of the books that I read when I was like younger, like age 10 and under, were definitely books like Beverly Cleary, Laura Ingalls Wilder, A.A. Milne. Like I had a lot of that, and, you know, The Secret Garden, like some like very like classic books in that respect. And I think my favorite like picture book from when I was a kid is Millions of Cats. Like I still have that now, and it's still a favorite that have given to each of my children. But those were probably the ones that I read a lot, concentrated in that part of my youth.
Oh, Blubber changed my life. Judy Blume. Yeah. She's, you know, I, you know, revered her. You know, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, that type of thing. So that's, you mentioned one book that you read to your own children. What else did you, I mean, cause obviously I would imagine you passed the love of books on to them as well. But you know, what did you read to them when they were little? And they're still little. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So we read all kinds of books. That is one thing. I'm like a minimalist in my life, but my children are really allowed to have as many books as they want. And so we read all kinds of things, but we do audio listening, like in the car and stuff like that. But just whatever we could really get our hands on. Some of the ones that I like kept from my childhood, and just whatever else they have grown to love. So we haven't really like pushed a certain type of book on them. Like my middle loves like graphic books. My oldest will like read pretty much anything. And then my youngest is like, as long as it's pink and it's got something sparkly on it, that's what I want to read. So we read what they want to read, really.
Yeah. I mean, I love libraries, and it breaks my heart that bookstores have disappeared. Maybe out in Oregon, they're still, you know,
so much here.
Yeah. It breaks my heart, cause they used to be on like on every, you know, corner.
Yeah.
And I remember going out, with my family for dinner, and the treat was to go get a book after dinner. And, you know, and again, you know, holding a book is a little different from reading online, at least for our, you know, being a digital immigrant. Maybe these digital natives can read a whole novel, you know, with the ones and zeros on their devices, and that might work fine for them. But, nothing like holding the book for me. But again, I'm a dinosaur. So your grandmother encouraged your love of reading. And but yeah. Writing, really, just a year? Because, you know, the way you
so started, like there have been, I will say this, nobody really like poured into me in that sort of way as far as like how I expressed myself like in the arts. It was always athletics. Like I always did like, you know, basketball and volleyball. And that was always praised and good grades. Those were things that got a lot of attention. And so the other part was never really like fostered in me, but my mom was a locomotive train engineer, and she used to go on trips and work for a long time. And she had saved this tiny little ripped poem that I'd written for her at one point and slipped into her rule book. And she gave it to me a few years ago. I mean, I'm 38, so it's very old. And it was this like wonderful poem that I wrote, like, if you see a booger rolling down the street, stop and give your friend a treat, or something ridiculous like that. But she kept it because she was just like, it was the funniest thing I had like read in the longest time. And I was like, okay, so there are some hints like in my past. Like I always wrote educational things. Like I wrote papers really well, and I wrote I write all the educational blogs for like our business and stuff like that. But like, yeah, I don't think I really gave myself permission to like try until like the world kind of went upside down.
Well, lucky us. I think being a part of your art, you know, obviously being a chef and creating, you know, and the idea of, you know, you're in the business of creating life. I mean, you're definitely, you know, just this deity of creation. I'm just so impressed. Tell me a little bit about now the short stories working and you're feeling a little more comfortable. I mean, oh my gosh, you almost have 3 dozen stories and have found good success and quite a following here on Readsy. Have you submitted to other contests and other writing platforms?
Yeah. So I just completed the second round of New York City Midnight, which is like 1,000-word flash fiction. I very stupidly, impulsively signed up for it when we went on a 5-day camping trip. And my first story, you know, they give you a prompt, like a genre, a location, and an object. And then you have 48 hours to write a 1,000-word story. And I like to do these things to, I think, make myself suffer. I did it in a tent on my cell phone on Google Docs. I submitted it. I was like, okay, it's what it is, right? And then I just did the second round about 2 weekends ago. We'll see how that goes. So yeah, I've submitted there and I've got a few other that I'm kind of tinkering with, like some stories that I'm getting ready to submit, like the microfiction, like 400 words and under, because again, I'm a sufferable fool like that, but yeah.
It's fine. It's competition.
Yeah.
Submittable is really good too. It kind of aggregates a whole bunch of contests. We'll put that on the blog, but Submittable does it. It's for free and it kind of will give you a nice grid and, you know, keeps track of all your rejections. but congratulations for learning all those New York City writers and making it to round 2. That's exciting. So now tell me, you've of all the stories you've written, is there a character that you miss that you really like, that you like? And is that the one that you're making into this new novel of yours?
Yeah. So I wrote one a few months ago. It's called Juska. And there's a character in that story that I really, really love. And he has Tourette syndrome. And it's just about like the awkwardness of like feeling like you're different and not noticeable. But then there's this thing that's very noticeable about you. And I think that's part of this novel that I've kind of started. Like, it's not about him, but it's about that energy of like, everybody feels that way at some point, maybe when they're young and when they're old, but it's kind of based off of that, those warm relationships that you have with people when you're growing up that you don't recognize are as valuable as you do at that time. But yeah.
Awesome. So like, have you thought about going into any other genre than kind of like the family dramas and the fiction? Are you going to write some sci-fi?
Oh my gosh. So that's so funny that you say that, because I am terrified of writing sci-fi and fantasy. I'm like, never, I don't get it. Like, I don't feel smart when I read these stories. I'm like, how do people come up with these like layered, like 7-layer sandwich stories? I don't get it. But also, hooray for them. And sure enough, that round, the second round of New York City Midnight, I was assigned fantasy, y'all. I was assigned fantasy and I was spitting mad. I waited 24 hours to even try and write the story. And then I wrote it. And then I have two associates on Readsies that like did beta reads for me. And they're like, this actually turned out really great. And I was like, oh, okay. So I guess I just need to stop telling myself that I'm not good at certain things. But yeah.
Just sounds like you need like more mountains to climb. Like, you can't write a novel and then you'll be done next week. Right. So,
I did sign up to do NaNoWriMo for November, whenever it happens. But again, we'll see how it goes.
Right in between, you know, bringing all these lovely spirits into the world. Very good.
Right.
Awesome. What do you have for our good friend?
Well, I'm a bit intrigued, actually, on the basis that you're saying you're writing 400-word stories and then you're writing novels. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you find the short things are easy, harder, or what's the sort of, what's easy, what's hard for you?
I don't think any of it's easy. I think they're just, I told my husband last night, I was like, you know, I'm a pantser, right? And he's like, what does that even mean? I was like, well, it means that like, I don't plot things. Like sometimes things just come to me and I just go with it. Like when I wrote Strong Exhale, that just came to me and I'm still going like, how did that come to me? Right. So yeah, sometimes it's really just whatever mood I'm kind of in. Like, it's not that one's harder than the other. It's just what's coming to me, which sounds very like fairy tale-ish, but
Okay, I mean, you obviously then enjoy what you're writing and all that, but what do you find difficult? What's the hardest bit of the writing then?
I think the hardest part of the writing for me is making sure that, like, I'm showing and not telling, because sometimes I will write and I'm writing in the way that I talk and I'm like, oh, okay, did I show there or was I telling everybody what happened? That also, you know, not letting myself be afraid that I'm not giving like some more details in areas where it's warranted, and also trusting it. Sometimes it's good and then I'm like, this is complete garbage, you know? And I think many of us feel that way.
So how do you, to focus on that for a second then, you know, when you say it's garbage, when do you know that it's, what makes for good writing? What do you see obviously is, oh, this is good, this is bad? What's your criteria for good and bad in that sense?
When I finish editing something or I shut my computer and I just kind of feel like my body feels warm and I smile, I'm like, oh, that felt good to write. Like there was a good feeling that came from making that piece of writing. Like that for me says, okay, there was something there. I did something good there.
And the flip side, obviously, what when you go, oh, this is garbage, or, you know, what when you read somebody else's writing and you're really, yeah, I'm not sure that's so well written, you know, what's the criteria for you of what's good and bad?
I fret a lot about it. Like, clearly, I'm a very emotions-based person. I fret a lot about it. I'm like, oh, maybe I should take that out. Like, I just mess with it more than I need to. And so that's a sign for me that, like, it's not great. I just need to walk away and come back. But honestly, like, maybe this is ego. Sometimes I just need other people to say if it's good or bad. People that I trust and respect. Like, what do you think? Like, this is what I was going for. What do you say? But yeah, that's really what I kind of use. It's like how my body feels when I'm done with it.
Right. Feedback. Feedback's a challenge, isn't it? You go, Deirdre.
Yeah. Have you found like another writer's community out your way? There seem to be a whole lot in the Pacific Northwest.
You know, I live right outside of the state capital here in Oregon. And even though it's our capital, it's not as large of a city as like, say, Portland is, which is like an hour and a half away from where I live. But it's very genre specific, the groups that I have found. It's all very like sci-fi and things like that. And I like something that's a little more open. So I've found a few other communities across the Midwest where I have friends that live like in Minnesota, and I've done some writing things online with them. And so that's been fun for me. But that's really what it looks like right now, aside from the few folks that I've met on Readsy and a few other places where I connect with them.
And finally, how do you find the time? You are, you know, you have this business, you have these children, you have an incredibly patient husband who's lovely.
And lovely.
where's your windows? Where do you find time to kind of sneak in?
I kind of write paragraph by paragraph at a time. So sometimes it looks like when my kids like are off to bed or my husband's putting them to bed, and I will just like get some in. And I will never be the person that's like, I'll have a 1,000-word story up in a day, not because I don't have the drive to do it, just because I'm fitting it in. And sometimes it looks like a lazy day, kind of like this, where I'll sit down and be like, I'm going to bust out 3 or 4 paragraphs or write down what I think I want to happen. But that's what it looks like for me.
On a mobile phone, in a tent. We already learned that. That's where she does it.
Yeah. It's like magic.
Listen. When
you have a lot of time on your hands.
Make it happen.
Yeah. So now what are the plans for the novel then? Just a paragraph at a time? Or are you going to carve out some chunks? Are you getting excited about it?
I am excited about it. It's an idea I've had for a really long time, for like probably 5+ years now. And I'm like, what am I doing? It's there. I need to just do it. I'm actually setting some goals for myself, not to like create or develop the plot or anything like that, but just to like actually start writing more of it every single week.
Tenacity. Yeah. Time and caffeine apparently is the rule of the day.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming by and giving us some of your valuable time and your valuable insight. We're so grateful for you and all the work you do. And we'll see you on the boards and see what else you have coming our way.
All right. Thanks for having me.
All right.
Thanks, Crochet, for coming in and having a chat. In our next segment, Deirdre draws on her avalanche of writing tips and provides a little snowflake that you may find useful in your writing. This episode, she's going to be talking about write small to write big, capturing small moments to engage your readers in big emotions.
Thanks, Russell. you know, writers who want to connect with their readers should kind of think about focusing on these small, precious moments, like a vignette, a little illustration of some pivotal moment in life, because we remember moments. Too many short stories I see want to write these big stories with big plots, you know, murder, abuse, and death, and divorce, or all of it. And it's kind of a barrage to the senses. We're not going to connect as much with something that's so just over the top and big and kind of claustrophobic, right? So these intimate moments are the ones that kind of get to our heart and to our emotions. It works out much better to write kind of something small to really kind of make these big connections. So about a decade or so ago, I give out a lot of writing prompts. Then it was about Halloween, so I assigned a Halloween story. And I had this one student, he was a freshman in high school, and he, Russell, was the scariest kid I've ever met in my entire life. He was brilliant, but I'm pretty sure he was pure evil. He was a scary guy. that's the worst combination for teachers, to have a brilliant child who is completely evil. So in his Halloween story, this boy turned in a two-page spooky story that was about systemic rape and suicide and kidnapping and murder. And I think even a homemade pipe bomb or something that killed a bunch of people, and a two-page story. And the worst part about it is that the story was grammatically correct and really technically perfect. He had written it just very well. It just was horrifying. And he had, you know, great characterization and some very bold imagery, maybe a little too bold. And of course, an engaging and horrific plot, because he had all of them, if not a manifesto there at the end. So I sent it, after reading it, to guidance with an A- on it and also a bushel of red flags for them to figure out. And I wrote, plot's a little too ambitious. Maybe you should just include an advisory warning. But that young man typified the idea of just writing big and making no connection except with his guidance counselor, who could hopefully give him some guidance. So, but even comedies and happy stories can just be too much. People want to write about meeting, you know, the love of your life on a first date and falling in love and the first fight and meeting the parents and the wedding and a second fight and kids and the next 1,200 fights or kitties and puppies, whatever. They just want to write too much and too big, and they want to cram all this plot into a story when they really should be focusing on the small moments that resonate. Currently, my poor godforsaken seniors are trying to hash out college essays. And it's been kind of a challenge to get them to think about these small moments that people understand and can connect with. And there's been some really powerful stories. I've had a boy write about peeing his pants in eighth grade and how embarrassing that was and just mortifying, and how he had run to the bathroom just to have another student run with him to give him his jacket to kind of cover up his embarrassment. And he wrote, I learned a lot about life and compassion in that one moment. Because that moment where you're just have mortified yourself to have another person, you know, reach out, you know, an olive branch, in this case, a jacket, you know, he remembered that for his whole life and what an impact that makes. I had another student write about how her parents set her and her sister down to explain that they were getting a divorce. And the parents then asked these two teenage girls, which parent did they want to live with? And we're waiting for an answer. And so her essay kind of talked about that, about how unfair that was. It's very Shakespearean. That seems like kind of King Lear stuff. But again, a moment we can identify with, just the horror of it, of having to pick between a parent to live with through no fault of your own. And then I had another student write about Ubering during a hurricane, a level 5 hurricane coming to hit South Florida, and her parents were in Moscow. So she had to Uber to get hurricane supplies to kind of ride out the storm. So again, these small moments that we can identify with, and not every moment, not all the big things, just kind of little stuff. I had a very accomplished young man write an essay about how his third grade teacher helped him discover that he was colorblind. And that was a mystery to him because he had done well in everything but art class, where he failed the color wheel, and mystery solved there. But what a revelation it was to him to really understand that it was a condition. And certainly we can empathize with that young man and having things about ourselves revealed to us that make sense in hindsight. So again, there's so many moments and so many chances to connect. Just you can't write everything in one story. Pick one or two small things and really kind of get us where we live in our heart and in our minds. I wanted to close with talking about how Shakespeare did this beautifully in his sonnets. Sonnet 130 is my favorite. It's he's talking about his mistress, and the speaker of the poem talks about how she has horrible lips and ugly breasts, and her hair is frizzy and nasty, and she has pale cheeks, and she has bad breath, and she has a terrible voice, and all these horrible things. And then the last two lines, the speaker says, "But I think my love is rare, as any belied with false compare," meaning that, you know, he knows his lover's faults, and he's very clear on that, but he knows that he loves her nonetheless. And that is a great connection. That is a great feeling. So that's it, Russell. Write small, write intimately, and write all the moments that bind us together.
Sadly, that's all we have time for on this episode. We would again like to thank Cruchet Hilton for coming on our podcast and providing insights into her writing. Coming up in the next episode, we'll be talking to Laura Clark, another great short story writer who is 14th on the Readsy Prompt leaderboard. So we're looking forward to that. Also coming up next episode, Deirdre will be reaching into the writing tips jar once again for another nugget of wisdom about how to improve your writing. But before we go, I'd just like to mention, coming out in the last week of September 2021 is a new podcast from Beth Connor, who was our first guest on this podcast series over at Crossroads Cantina. The story is written by Lizzie Fuller, who was our fourth guest on this podcast series, and also features myself as one of the characters. So I hope you'll enjoy that. Well, that's it for this episode. So on behalf of Deirdre and myself and the entire team here at readlotswritelots.com, till next time, thanks for listening and bye for now.